Okay, it is September, sometime in the middle of September.
It's the 15th.
And we're picking up around Henry's graduation from Pomona.
Okay, hit it.
Yeah, made Phi Beta and a few other miscellany. And I recall that we talked a little about my applying to graduate schools. Wasn't able to get the deal that I needed and wanted at the University of Chicago, but I did get something at the University of Hawaii. And it's a fair indication of my disorganization and lack of focus and procrastination and various other shortcomings, that I didn't have the vaguest idea what I was getting into in going out to the territory of Hawaii. Now, you must remember, this was 1949. Hawaii was not a state. And as a territory, well, it was lacking a lot of things, including political representation. And at that time, the governor was appointed by the president. And of course, in 1949, the president of the United States was Dwight D. Eisenhower. And therefore, the governor of Hawaii was a Republican, regardless of the feelings of the people of the state. However, I didn't know any of that. All I knew was some sentimental kind of vision that Hawaii was a paradise on earth in which all of the cultures and races and ethnic groups got together beautifully and so forth and so on. And that I would go out there and study them as a model of what what race relations might be like in the United States, if one really worked at it hard enough. And I didn't have the wits to do any research. I didn't even have the wits to talk to my mentor at Pomona, who must have known what was really like out there, and he must have known the faculty members at the sociology department at the University of Hawaii. But I didn't do any of that kind of preparation. I went out just naive as can be. The trip out was interesting in itself because I'd never been out at sea before. I took a ship which turned out to be a troop, well, it had been originally a passenger ship before the war. It was used as a troop ship during the war and had not been reconverted even as long after the war as 1949. So the accommodations were primitive, to say the least. The two genders were separated. Well, can you turn that off?
Pause.
I'm not sure if I should pause it.
Hello? Who's this? Who are you again? Hello? For crap's sake.
A brief interruption.
Virginia, you're going out for a walk, is that right? Oh, boy. If the phone rings again, maybe I'll just take the whole damn thing off the hook.
Why not? Do that.
That'll fix their wagon. An unreconverted troop ship in which there were bunks in the male quarters. I don't know what they were like in the female quarters. But my most vivid memory is it was my first introduction to feeding on a ship, even though it had very little of any resemblance to a cruise ship. It had in common with a cruise ship that you could order anything and everything off the menu at every meal. Talk about paradise. That was my idea of paradise. And I was able to take advantage of it because I had the good luck to have the same family physician who saw me through my illness when I was a junior in high school, who knew about sulfa drugs, which were new at that time, and she saved my life from scarlet fever. So anyway, come the trip to Hawaii, she knew about Dramamine, which I think was also quite new at that time. And I was one of the few passengers on the good ship Cleveland who took Dramamine and therefore did not get seasick. So I enjoyed the trip.
Where did you leave? Where did
Pardon me?
Leave from?
San Francisco. I guess it took 4 or 5 days. And I was met by some member of the faculty at the university who drove me up to what was to be my residence, which was something called the Veterans Dormitory. Oh dear, I'm in trouble. The vet's dorm, so-called, was in fact more like a very large chicken shed. in which there were little cubicles set apart by the flimsiest of material between them, and there was no glass in the whole building. Because of the weather out there, it was assumed to be so mild that screens were all that you needed, both screen doors and screened windows. But the price was right. The price, there were bunk beds in each of these cubicles, and if you wanted the whole room for yourself, which I did, the rent was $18 a month. Some of the guys doubled up, and that meant they only had to pay $9 a piece. Now, I can't recall what the teaching assistants were being paid at that time. It might have been something on the order of $200 a month. Because I was on one of these deals where I was only going to be studying half-time and the rest of the time I was helping with the introductory sociology class sections. Thank goodness I had another TA. He and I shared the same office space. And he had been there the previous year, so he knew the ropes. And he was a very great help to me in all kinds of ways. He also lived in the vet's dorm. His name was Dick Collar, and he and I kept him.
For a minute, I thought you were going to say Dick Jennings.
No.
You finally got rid of Dick Jennings.
Actually, I didn't see Dick Jennings again for about 50 years. But then we ran into each other again at the 50th reunion of our Pali High graduation class. Anyway, Dick Collar, as I say, was a great help. And he told me about some of the facts of life. And I learned, for example, that there were many and varied ethnic groups out there, all of whom did not get along in perfect harmony, and the class distinction seemed to go something like Howleys, who were whites, being at the top, and they were subdivided between those who had been there for some time and occupied positions of real power and influence in the business world and political world, and they owned the newspapers and so forth. And then there were newcomers. The new Howleys had a different name. I can't remember what it was. But that would include the service personnel, of whom there were a good many, and people such as myself. Below them in the rankings came the Chinese, who were not terribly numerous, but they were quite prestigious because of their skills at business, and they also had some political influence. And then came the Japanese, who were by far the most numerous group, probably at least 50%. And that had much to do with the fact that Hawaii was having a terrible time getting to move from the position of territory to statehood. And then below the Japanese came Koreans and Puerto Ricans, and there were a few blacks.
Not the Hawaiians.
And then at the bottom of the list would come the Hawaiians, of whom there were very few left, because they intermingled with all of the other groups. Very few Hawaiians left. A lot of difficulty in maintaining the culture and even the language. And it was very controversial. As to whether they should be given special privileges and so forth and so on. Well, one of my first acts was to try to organize a chapter of student Federalists. I believe I mentioned the fact that at Pomona I had been very active in the World Federalist Movement, and so I carried that on out there and organized a chapter, which only required that I get 10 dues-paying members. The teaching of sociology was rather simple. It was largely limited to the study of social structures like class distinctions, upper, upper, lower upper middle, lower middle, blah, blah, blah. And social institutions, the family, the church, and all of this neatly arranged divisions. And it wasn't very inspiring. Fortunately, Hawaii was quite a magnet for visiting professors from the mainland who were able to use their sabbaticals to teach a course or two at the University of Hawaii and then spend the rest of their time surfing or fishing or enjoying life in the tropics. And one of the visiting professors when I was out there was from the University of Chicago, which is where they had the best department of sociology in the country, I think. And this fellow was a breath of fresh air in that he didn't want anything to do with these traditional sociological charts and divisions of rather arbitrary means. He didn't call himself this, but I looked upon him as a humanistic sociologist. He believed, well, he spent a lot of his time at all of his classes, in the early portions of these classes at least. He began by attacking the hidebound ways of looking at human nature and human organization. He attacked the Pavlov theory of conditioned responses. He attacked the school of social Darwinism. He attacked Freudianism. He attacked the school that believed in innate instincts, like the theory that the man is by nature a warlike, aggressive being, and so forth and so on and so on. Herbert Bloomer, which was his name, believed that all kinds of things are possible, that people are capable, not only capable of change and choice, but in fact are obliged to go through life making choices because they are not given any inborn solutions to situations in which they find themselves. And therefore, when you find yourself in a situation of any type, you have to briefly review the experiences that you may have had with that type of situation before, how you dealt with it before, whether you succeeded in dealing with it satisfactorily, and whether you were influenced by the people you were with, and so forth. And all of these things were happening almost instantaneously, but they happened constantly. And that you go through life making hundreds of these definitions of the situation, as he called it. And that although maybe 90 times out of 100, you do something on the basis of what you've done before, but there is always a possibility that you might do it differently. And therefore, individuals change, and sometimes societies as a whole change. He was greatly interested in that. And that led to a whole field of sociology, which he called collective behavior, which included things like social movements, fads and fashions and anything which kicks over the traces of what had been done before. And that, to me, that was like catnip to a cat. That was what I was interested in. Because, as I have said before in some of these sessions, I had become interested in the Zionist movement, one of my first feelings of that sort. Then I became interested in the what might be called the civil rights movement. In my position with the Inspector General's office at Fort Lewis, Washington, then I became fascinated by the vision of a world federal government. All of this was in the field of social change. And that was, to me, the only thing that I've found really attractive about the whole field of sociology. Another thing which Herbert Bloomer attacked was what was known as the survey research method of social investigation, which consisted of going out and asking a sample of the population a question or two about their opinion of this or that social issue of the moment. And Bloomer had nothing but contempt for that as being blind to the realities of society in which everyone is not an interchangeable part. One person's opinion doesn't count as much as another person's opinion, depending on their education and their place in the economic structure, etc., etc., etc. And therefore, it's useless to talk about the results of a survey as though everybody's opinion counts exactly as much as everybody else's. One needs to know the real workings of the society in a qualitative rather than quantitative way. So all of this I found very, very agreeable. And I began trying to learn the workings of the Society of the Hawaiian Territory as best I could. I learned, for example, I had never known this before going out there, that the ILWU, that's the Longshoremen's Union, which had become quite a power in San Francisco as a result of its tactics in the 1930s, I learned that the ILWU had done something in the Hawaiian Islands that nobody had ever been able to do in the continental United States at that time, and that was to organize agricultural workers. They had organized the pineapple and sugarcane workers successfully. And I also learned that that was another reason why the spokespeople for Hawaii, they had a territorial representative in Congress who was allowed, I think, allowed the privilege of appearing on the floor of the House of Representatives, along with a representative from Puerto Rico and possibly Guam and so forth, but without the right to vote. But they did have spokespersons back there in Washington who were lobbying at all times to try to get statehood for Hawaii. At pretty much the same time that representatives from Alaska were trying to get statehood for Alaska, even though at that time the population of Alaska was much smaller than Hawaii, and it didn't have any oil and gas industry at that time. But I learned about all of these kinds of things, and I remember attending some social gatherings of the ILWU. I remember that it was the only time in my life that I ever won a door prize consisting of a bottle of champagne. But I listened to all of the people talking politics, and the ILWU was very left-wing union. In fact, I didn't know it at the time, but I had reason to believe later that, in fact, it probably was communist dominated. As a friend of mine put it, on the basis of his personal knowledge, the only reason Harry Bridges was not a dues-paying member of the CP is that he was too cheap to pay dues. But anyway, this was a new kind of experience for me. I had never known people that far left before, and it was part of my education of as to how the real life works. Some unions were like that and some unions weren't. Now, in June of 1950, which was the middle of, well, it was the ending of my first year out there. I had signed up for a 2-year agreement. In June of 1950, North Korea invaded South Korea. The country of Korea had not been independent for a long time. I think Japan took over Korea in the early part of the 1900s. And after Japan was defeated in World War II, the peninsula of Korea was arbitrarily divided in the north and south to give the Soviet Union what it wanted, which was a zone of influence, and the U.S. was the prime mover in the south portion. Anyway, the north invaded the south, and that led to the Korean War, which dragged on for several years and affected me. Because, as I may have mentioned last time when I talked about my so-called army career, my discharge said I was recommended for further military duty. And the draft had never been terminated after the end of World War II. It was still going strong, and all they had to do was bring back the same guys to the draft boards to begin drafting people to send to Korea. And I've learned that as long as I stayed in school, I could get deferments. So when it came to my second year, in which I was entitled to continue as a teaching assistant, a complication arose in that one of the star graduate students in sociology, who happens to have been Japanese American, was having financial difficulties, and desperately needed a job as a TA. And if he wasn't able to get it, he would have had to drop out of school. Well, I didn't want to see that happen, and therefore I voluntarily relinquished my job and went back into the GI Bill of Rights. So I was able to get along better financially, actually, in my second year out there than I had been the first. On the $200 a month or whatever it is that I was getting. If you think I'm a penny pincher nowadays, you should have seen me in those days. There were long periods of time in which I got along on a dollar a day for food with the help of an occasional care package from home, and sometimes a friend might invite me out. My friend Dick Collar introduced me to the institution known as a luau, which I heartily recommend to any of you who like to eat. And if you ever have a chance, take advantage of it. Wonderful. Based around cooking an entire pig in an underground excavation called an emu, and all kinds of other dishes, lomi lomi salmon and chicken lao lao and so forth. All you could eat and all the beer you could drink. So I ate and drank enough on that occasion to see me through about a month. Anyway, I got through the year, and then in the second year I was able to start going out to restaurants and things like that. I'm trying to remember. If there's anything particularly remarkable, okay. It came time for me to write a thesis to get my master's in sociology. And I decided that the subject of my thesis would be an analysis of the world government movement. Which I would write about from the inside, having been a member and a sort of leader of it myself for 2 or 3 years. And that's another one of the things I learned from Herbert Bloomer, and that's the fact that what was needed in the study of collective behavior was not people from the outside, it would go in to interview members of the world government movement. On the grounds, on the theory that being objective, their analysis wouldn't thereby be tainted. It would be objective, and that was a great virtue. So went the theory. Well, Bloomer thought, in fact, objectivity be damned. What was needed was people who were on the inside who would be able to shed some insight on the question of why these people believed in this cause so strongly, and subjective questions of that sort. And so I approached my thesis from that point of view. But I still was handicapped by my failing of procrastination, which dogged me all along through college, right until the very end of my senior year, when I was due to write a senior paper regarding my research into the housing situation in a ghetto of Los Angeles. And it was due by a date certain. And I worked on that thing until 11:59 p.m. and snuck the paper under the front door of my mentor in his home, which was fortunately very close to campus. But when it came to my district, my thesis at the University of Hawaii, I carried things too far. And I failed entirely to get it in by the deadline for that, which was in May, I guess, the end of May in 1951. And I had already made a plane reservation to fly home. So I had to get a special dispensation from my faculty committee that I would finish it up at home and mail it back by the end of the summer. And they agreed. And my diploma, therefore, was also deferred. So when I got home, and we were living in Los Altos at that time, and that particular summer, I didn't spend any time supervising the apricot harvest. I spent my time on finishing the thesis, and my mother convinced me to hire a professional typist. So all that I would need to do was crank out the rough copy, which I did, and I set a personal record by turning out 30, I believe it was 30 pages of copy in one day. And I did, in fact, get the whole thing in by the end of the summer and did get an MA. And then embarked on the next step in my education, which was to begin in the doctoral program at the Stanford Department of Sociology. Now, I was able to get a teaching assistantship there also. So that took care of the problem of tuition and the problem of room and board was taken care of by the fact that I was living at home. Now, the grand old man of the Stanford Sociology Department was named LaPierre, and he had written one of the only books, in fact, I think maybe the only book, in the field of collective behavior, which was the field that I was so interested in. I would have gone to Stanford anyway, so this was just serendipitous. That was a strong argument for my studying there for a doctorate. On the other side of the scale was the fact that it was a very small department, smaller than the Department of Sociology at Hawaii, and not well thought of in the academic pecking order of this country. There was one other professor named Paul Wallen who was kind of their methodologist. LaPierre was the writer and theorist. And once again, I taught a section of the introductory course. One of my outstanding memories of that year is the shot heard round the world which took place in the world of baseball back in New York, where the New York Giants were playing the Brooklyn Dodgers for the right to go to the World Series. And this ultimate game was taking place on the same afternoon that I was scheduled to meet my section. So I put a sign on the door of that classroom saying I couldn't meet them that day because I was I was in the student union listening to the baseball game. So I got to hear the so-called shot heard around the world in which the home run was hit in the bottom of the ninth to win that game. And I'm sure that David remembers hearing that because it was rebroadcast for many years afterwards, including right up to the present time. But for the most part, I can't remember much. Except one thing, well, two things. One, I wasn't learning much about making the world a better place to live. In other words, I wasn't learning much of anything about the nuts and bolts of social action. It looked to me as though I could see what was going on among my colleagues. And there were about six or eight of us in the doctoral program. It looked to me as though I was on a treadmill going only in one direction, and that was to get some job at a minor college or university after I got a PhD. I could probably get a job as an assistant professor someplace. And if I kept my nose clean for enough number of years and write a sufficient number of articles that were published in some publication or other, I could become an associate professor and so forth and so on. And that wasn't very exciting. So I began looking for something in the real world. And lo and behold, I found an ad in the San Francisco Chronicle that they were looking for somebody who knew something about sociology in the California Department of Public Health. which at that time had its headquarters in San Francisco. I had made some applications elsewhere, including some that were pretty preposterous. In fact, there came a time when I got an inkling of how some of the real world operates by trying to sell encyclopedias door to door. Actually, I was accompanying somebody who was head of a team. If I had been on my own, that would have been impossible. But it was impossible enough, even just tagging along this other guy. But I was accepted by the Department of Public Health, pending my written and oral exam and so forth, and they said that would be no problem. My beginning position would be as a junior analyst or something of the sort in their records and statistics department. But I thought it would be a foot in the door. And secondly, and at this point, I have to say that up to this point, I haven't been totally forthcoming about my adventures and misadventures in affairs of the heart. And of the spleen and other organs. I don't believe that in the course of this oral history there is any particular virtue to be served by kissing and telling all. This is to be a history of things that really affected my life in some measurable way. So I now come to a point at which an affair of the heart did have a powerful effect, a profound effect on things that happened afterwards. And it began in a meeting of student Federalists at Stanford, where I was once again active in that chapter. I was no longer head of the chapter. It suited me just fine. The head of the chapter was a guy named Fritjof Tigerson. And after the meeting at this particular time, I guess it was the fall of 1951, or maybe 52. Anyway, after the meeting broke up, Fritjof said, there was a young lady that needed a ride home after the meeting, and would I give her a lift? So I did. And one thing led to another. Yeah, I began, let's see now. Yeah, this must have been 1952. I began working for the health department the day after the election. There was a presidential election in November of 1952, in which the Democratic nominee was Adlai Stevenson, and the Republican nominee was Dwight Eisenhower. Do I have this right? In any event, all of this overlapped my romance with the lady that Fritjof Tigers introduced me to. Which resulted in our getting married. And her name was Alice Van Cleek Enderton. But she was known at that time as Pamela. So that's how I called her. And things went along with my working at the health department in San Francisco. My buying a house in Larkspur for $12,000. Quite a nice house among the redwood trees. And in January of 1953, she had a child who was a son, as the firstborn in the Anderson family.
Always 54?
I thought it was 53.
Well, I was born in 55, towards the end of the year. And Stephen is separated from me only
by 18 months. So maybe it was 54. Okay. Now,
so was she involved in the Student Federalists or just...
She was very active in the Student Federalists. Extremely active. I wouldn't have been interested in her if she weren't. I was getting restive in the Bureau of Records and Statistics because it wasn't really coming to grips with things that were wrong in the world. And so I began to look around, and one of the things that came to my attention was a fellowship. A grant, or whatever was the terminology, to be given under the auspices of the head of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota, I believe it was, under the direction of an anthropologist named Melville Herskovitz. And it would have allowed carte blanche to somebody who wanted to pursue a research project in the general field of the behavioral sciences. So even though I did not have much experience with anthropology, I'd only taken a course or two, I thought I might apply for this. And here's the important part. Pam, in her time at Stanford, had made good friends with a couple of guys from Kenya. One of them was a doctor and the other was a political scientist. And between the four of us, we hatched up an idea that would consist of calling upon my two backgrounds, one of them in sociology and one in public health, which would look at the folkways in the field of medicine on the part of the indigenous people of Kenya. And it's pretty wacky when I think about it, but at the time I thought I really had a shot at it because I was able to get recommendations from Herbert Bloomer, who by this time had moved on from the University of Chicago to become chairman of the Department of Sociology at Berkeley. I had a recommendation from the head of the department at Stanford, my friend Richard LaPierre. I had a strong recommendation from the head of the Hoover Institution, who was a very, very good friend of my mother's, from the fact that his child had attended the Anderson Nursery School. A strong recommendation from the father of the IQ test. By this time he was long retired, but he was a psychologist named Lewis Terman. Whose grandchildren, of whom he had three, had all attended this Anderson Nursery School. And I also got strong recommendations from these two Kenyans, who were destined for great things, as a matter of fact. After they graduated from Stanford, one of them became highly placed in the health service of Kenya after it became independent, and the other became very active in the civil service. At the very same time that I had all of these recommendations and my plan, my grand plan for original research on the subject of the health ways of the Kikuyu tribe, there came to my attention the fact that a professor at the School of Public Health at the University in Berkeley was looking for an assistant to help him set up a course to be called Medical Sociology. And I applied for that. So I had these two irons in the fire, either of which would have offered me an escape from the boredom of the Bureau of Records and Statistics. It came down to the last day in which the fellow at the university was willing to consider my application. And I had not heard from Melville Herskovitz at the University of Minnesota or wherever he was, Wisconsin, one of those. Anyway, I put in a long distance call to the Department of Anthropology at that university, and was able to talk to somebody who seemed to know what she was talking about. And I said I had an application in, and I would like very much to know if she had any inkling of whether I had made one of the cuts. Mm-hmm. In other words, whether I had a chance at all. And she broke the news to me gently that I didn't have the chance of a snowball in hell, namely because I was not an anthropologist. That's the way the world works. So I went over to Berkeley at my earliest opportunities and talked with this fellow and said I would like very much to work with him, and he liked the cut of my jib, as he put it, and I was hired on the spot. So I then gave the word to my friends and colleagues at the School of Public Health, I mean at the Department of Public Health, not to be confused with the School of Public Health. And that will lead us on to the next chapter in these reminiscences, which we'll take up next time.
Okay.